Hi, everybody. Welcome to part two of my Favorites of 09 series of podcasts featuring several configurations of the Gamers Confab. In this episode, I'm joined by Lee Alexander, news director at Gamma Sutra and author of the wonderful Sexy Video Game Land blog. Also by writer, critic, and designer Corvus Elrod from Zackle Rose Studio. And by Nels Anderson, a gameplay programmer at Hothead Studios. I want to thank all of them for joining me on the show. I invite you to check out the previous episode, as well as the two upcoming shows that will appear in the coming days, and those will round out the series. Hope you enjoy the show. Away we go. I want to welcome Lee Alexander, Corvus Elrod, and Nels Anderson back to the Gamers Confab, all veterans of the podcast, and it's great to have you all aboard. You all doing good? Happy holidays. Happy New Year to come.
Same to you. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure, and this is our segment where we talk about our favorite game of 2009, and we have a broad definition of that. So, as I've said before, it may not necessarily be the same game that you would consider game of the year, whatever that means, but your favorite game may just be the game that had the kind of biggest personal impact on you this year, or just for whatever reason is your favorite. So we'll kind of go around the horn, and why don't we begin with you, Corvus?
My favorite game of the year, it has to be Today I Die. Daniel Bergenwee's little flash game from March or April. It was officially released, I believe. I saw it at GDC in the experimental gameplay sessions.
So for people that haven't played that, could you describe it? Because I would imagine that game, some people may know about it, but a fair number may not.
Yeah, so Today I Die is very sort of experimental interpretation of what game mechanics can do. And if you're all familiar with my blog, I really focus on the storytelling capacity of game mechanics themselves and how they can convey meaning. And Today I Die really nails that. There's no traditional game structure involved. There's a poem on the screen that has some highlighted words in it. By interacting with the scenes that sort of represent the poem, you can unlock new verbs and some new adjectives. And it changes the scenes and changes the way characters within the scenes interact. And as I was thinking about what I wanted to have my favorite game of the year, what I wanted to talk about, I realized that this is the game that sort of helped me define my motto about my approach to playing all video games, which is don't try to read it like a game, play it like a poem. And so it's kind of become my high watermark. If I can play a game as if it's a poem, like if I can find meaning inherent in the rhythms and the structure of the game, then it's the type of game that really appeals to me, that I feel emulates the strength of video games. I've stunned you all into complete silence.
I know.
So I remember when I played that, and it was definitely interesting. The one challenge I remember I really had when I was playing it is there wasn't a lot of feedback from the gameplay systems themselves, which is good in some way, but it kind of had the problem with I never knew when I was finished, right? Yeah. Like I didn't know when there was more content. I didn't know if like I was done because I figured out everything, or if I was just kind of stuck and not doing things right. And that was one thing I was less fond of. I don't know if that was just specific to the way that like the path I took, and I just got stuck in an area or whatever. But like kind of that core conceit is definitely very, very interesting. I like that quite a bit.
Well, what I find about Today I Die is a lot of people had a very negative reaction to it, particularly old school adventure game designers and players who felt that this game should really specifically appeal to them. But that lack of feedback was a big part of their complaint. Mm-hmm. And my contention is that, I mean, this isn't a literary work in scope. It is very much just a short poem. And when you're reading a short poem, some people just read it and move on and never really sort of dig into it to find more meaning. They don't explore it in any sort of depth. They just kind of read it and move on. And a lot of people did that with Today I Die. But because they were categorizing it as a game, they felt that it failed to reach them. It failed in its mission. It's poorly designed. I actually had people argue with me that it was a terribly designed game.
It is a game. It can't be anything other than a game. So I think that's kind of valid, actually.
Sure, but why? But if it doesn't fit our sort of classic model of how you're supposed to structure a game, how you're supposed to work with game mechanics, I don't think he was trying to. Like, if he was trying to make something that was more traditionally game-like, I can see that you could say it failed.
Sure.
But regardless of what you do, you can have an experience with it. And so it strips bare a lot of those conceits that we have about what a game is. It has to provide challenge. It has to provide feedback. There has to be a success state. Like, I would argue that there is no success state to Today I Die. You might see it through to where you can't get any more meaning out of it, but you didn't win it, and you can't lose it. There is no success state. There are just layers of meaning, and you uncover them or you don't.
Sure, fair enough. I had the same issue that Nels had with it. I definitely liked it. I thought it was interesting, and it was fun to explore. And to me, like, the lack of feedback became like the central mechanic, that trying to figure out what you were quote unquote supposed to do. But I don't really think that I can get behind something that's that opaque, that is so opaque to so many people. I think that video games are video games for a reason, and that's because they have, some rules, some conditions, some sort of structure. And, I don't necessarily think a success state has to be a win or lose, but when the destination isn't clear, and when the result isn't clear, and when the end isn't clear, I don't know if that's so much even going to be a game, or rather than, as opposed to an interesting work of interactive poetry. You know what I mean?
Sure. I can see that point, and I'm not arguing by any means that all games should seek to emulate Today I Die's structure. And I do think it was a very sort of artistic, abstract effort. But I think we need people doing that. I think we have to have people who are making things that don't appeal to the broad masses. Like, why do video games have to try to appeal to a huge audience?
Agreed.
Well,
agreed,
because
definitely.
They're a commercial art. And if they don't, then they're not going to get funded. I mean, that's the answer to that question. But when we're doing these little individual one-off games where, he's not trying to make a huge budget to support a huge team, I think it's really important that we do struggle and we do make things that are largely inaccessible to large audiences now and then.
Totally. I mean, people need to try to push the envelope for sure. I think it's good that he explored that. I like his other game better with the octopus tentacle.
That's not him.
Not him. Shoot. No, you're right. No, the one that I'm thinking of that he did is the moon one, right?
Which he also showed briefly at GDC, I think, when we were there.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, but there's
and, been and Storyteller is good as well.
Yeah.
That one I did not try.
You know, the poetry metaphor is interesting. I don't know, that's probably not the right word. It's more of just you're sort of paralleling it in a way with what poems do. I played the game... Really, I think probably shortly after you mentioned it, because I think I'd seen it at GDC and then it stopped paying attention, when it came out. So I think, Corvus, I think you sort of mentioned somewhere that it was out, and so I played it. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can play it in 15 minutes, so it doesn't, you're not going to be, tied up with a game for hours and hours. But it's one of those games that I brought back with me on my laptop and had a few people take a look at that I sort of always use as kind of my test audience here where I teach. Because it's fun to give them games like, I did this with Scribblenauts too. And these are like mostly not what you would describe as gamers. They're like English professors and stuff. Their responses were a bit like how people respond to poetry, which is some people kind of like got it and were able to sort of play with it and explore it. And other people just found it like inaccessible. And it just was quickly apparent they didn't even know what to do. What am I supposed to do? That reaction, right? You'll see people have, and they'll kind of look at you like, well, and I would be like, oh, I'm not going to tell you what to do. Just play with it. And then, they just got frustrated and walked away. But there were people, not the majority, but there were two or three people that played with it and kind of saw it through to the end, and kind of it felt like a little discovery to them. So,
And, you know, I mean, I see a lot of people have that exact same reaction to E.E. Cummings, for example.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious, do you think, I mean, how much of a factor is your experience as a gamer or your sort of long experience with playing games and thinking about game mechanics and game design? How much does that inform the way you respond to a game like this?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, it informs my approach 100%, but there are a lot of other people with a lot longer history of doing game design and thinking about game mechanics that had, you know, the complete 180 response that I did to this. Mm-hmm. But what specifically made it appeal so much to me was it completely integrates the textual elements into the gameplay itself, and that the individual relationships described within the scene had meaning that impacted the text and vice versa. And so instead of having this sort of stratified, here is our narrative, it is text, now go play a game and come back and we will read more text to you, it became this really satisfying sort of balance between the mechanics and the words.
Yeah. Well, the conversation about the game, I think, was just about as interesting as the game. On his site and other places, people talked about this game. Maybe I'll try to link to some of those conversations when I post the podcast. I can't help but thinking, looking at the conversation, I've been kind of catching up on it as we've been talking a little bit here. It's, we don't do a very good job of talking about games.
No.
yep.
I mean, it's just this kind of endless series of, I couldn't figure it out. It was brilliant. You don't know what you're talking about. It's amazing. People respond however they respond. So I don't mean to suggest that they're just all idiots or something, but it's hard to find a really useful discussion that kind of can help amplify or, you know, in any way kind of just give you a different entree into the game.
Yeah, that's like why we have Corvus then.
I guess so.
It's interesting you should say that, because one of my things is that video games are, as a medium or as a discipline, or a conversation between the author and the audience, and they're a much more sort of direct conversation loop than a lot of other media.
Mm. Yeah.
We can patch things, right? And so to address our audience's concerns. And so I'm really trying to just look at that communication and how it happens. And I'm trying to do so in a way that doesn't necessarily judge. Well, it doesn't try to lay blame for success or failure. So I can acknowledge that Today I Die failed to reach a lot of people, but that isn't necessarily because it was poorly designed or because the audience was stupid. It just
means that I think that there was a smaller audience for it. It wasn't meant to reach a ton of people.
Right. Yeah. Right. And to analyze why it didn't work, like getting that feedback about the lack of feedback within the game, is very important to sort of understanding and contextualizing the role games can play in order to reach their audience.
Exactly. And I don't know that he should have done anything different. You know, it works the way that he did it. It just, you know, it limits the audience and it requires someone, you know, like you, who's willing to confront, challenge, explore, and discuss it. You know, different people want different things from games. So
yeah. No, it's actually very interesting, because it seems that for the vast, vast majority of people, like accessibility or whether or not you personally enjoyed it is like a core criterion for evaluating, you know, a game, right?
Right.
But with other media, it isn't quite like that. Like I saw a fantastic but super avant-garde production of Tom Waits' Black Rider here in Vancouver, like maybe a year and a half ago. It was so nice. Good. But a lot of the people I saw with there's like, that was crazy. I didn't get it. It was so weird, but it wasn't like they were saying it was bad or it was poor. It just kind of, you know, it didn't hit them in the same places that it hit me. But that was fine. It was like not to my taste. But people almost never say that about games, right?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Or it sucks. I didn't like it, so it sucks.
There's an it's good or it's bad, or it made sense or it didn't make sense. Whether or not it makes sense is a crucial and pivotal, you know, rightly or wrongly, has become a pivotal criteria in the evaluation of games. Like, you know, I didn't understand it, therefore it failed. And that's very, you know, I think people are much more patient with other art, as you said.
I keep coming back to Ishiguro's The Unconsoled, which is a book I read for a book club.
Yeah.
And I hated it. I hated every single page. I would slam the book down in frustration the way gamers throw controllers. I mean, I hated this book. It was like my own sort of literary Ninja Gaiden. It just was such a struggle to get through. And as soon as I was done reading it and started talking about it with the one other person in the book club who actually finished it with me, whom I went on to marry, by the way, I fell in love with it. I don't know that I'll ever be able to read it again, but not a week goes by, not a conversation like this one doesn't go by that I think about how important that book is to my sort of thinking about the creative process and how we try to communicate with people through creative output. Such an important book. But I joke that I've actually wrapped mine in cement and buried it so that if I ever decide to reread it, I really have to be committed to retrieving it and rereading it. It'd be equally hard, if not more hard, the second time through. And if a book can do that, why can't a
book? Wow. Exactly. Well, just to challenge, you know, the readers, I'm going to put a link to that book on my site along with your picture, Corvus, because I tried to read that book and oh my God.
They can come after him for it.
They can come after you, Corvus, for that.
I warned them. Like I said, hey, this is great. Everyone should read it. Whatever you do, don't read this book.
Well, Corvus's game is Today I Die, and I'll obviously put a link there. And, you know, just we should also mention you can donate to the developer, you know, the designer of the game on his site, and I'll have a link there too. And that's probably a good thing to do.
Yeah, you totally should do that.
Absolutely.
So let's hand the ball to Nels. What you got, Nels?
So it's definitely not an objectively best game. Maybe not favorite. I have a hard time picking favorites, but definitely one of the games last year that I played that was the most interesting that I really, really enjoyed was Little King Story. One of the tiny handful of Wii games I actually played last year. I know, Michael, you played it for a bit. Lee or Corvus, did either of you guys play it?
No, I had it and then my cat chewed through the sensor bar cord on my Wii around the time that it launched and I didn't actually replace it until I didn't end up replacing it until later in the year when I had a Wii review that I had to do. And now it's there and it's waiting its turn. I think I'm probably going to pick it up now.
She just used my cat ate it excuse. I can't believe that. She actually used my cat ate it excuse.
Yeah, she really did. No, she really did break my Wii. I swear to God.
I've lost several controllers to angry kitties back when I was living at home. So yeah. I believe that.
Her name is Zelda, too.
I've heard. That is so fantastic.
She's kind of bummed about no Wii Zelda announced this year, so she decided to sabotage the system. Anyway, sorry, continue.
So what I liked about Little King Story was that it was a game that has like a ton of personality. It's weird because it's, and this is probably the reason why not that many people played it, is it's a really hard game to communicate, both sort of mechanically and aesthetically. Like mechanically, it's this weird combination between like lemmings and Pikmin and populace, kind of.
Yeah. No, I did see it actually. I previewed it when they were doing the press tour of it. So I've played some of it, but
yeah. And then the tone itself, like aesthetically, it looks like art style wise and everything. It's very like painterly a bit, like it is kiddie or cartoonish. But the actual tone itself kind of oscillates madly between being really whimsical and lighthearted to really kind of dark and somber. And it does this just madly. Yeah,
it was kind of disconcerting at times.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
I read what Michael did quite a lot of writing about it, didn't you, Michael?
Yeah, I did. I just love this game so much.
About losing your townspeople, sadly.
Yeah, and it sneaks up on you. You don't really expect that's you'll have any attachment to them or anything. You know, but, you know, they have names.
It totally pulls the XCOM thing, right?
Totally, yeah. And they have children. They have children that become part of the town, you know?
Yeah, and if you actually like lose all your health and perish, you are treated to just the most heartbreaking game over screen ever. Like the first time it happened, I just sat there in stunned silence for like 30 seconds because it was so devastating. And I was just, and that is matched up against a super whimsical, lighthearted, you know, romping around, exploring. It's just so bizarre and delightful. The I'm going to keep going through the stuff I like, and then I'll get to the stuff I don't like so much. The bosses in the game are fantastic. The presentation up to them is this crazy, like, watercolor style cutscene thing that's awesome. And then the fights themselves, mechanically, they're all super distinct, but they all still kind of fit into the core stuff you've been learning in the game a bit. Those are just so good. This is also why it's interesting, is it was made by Sing and another developer. It's kind of a collaboration, but they're all super Japanese. And it really kind of draws out how isolated some of the Japanese development is from...
Yeah, sort of, like, I love that, though. That's awesome.
It's good. It's definitely good in that you get crazy games like this. You get, you know, folks like Keita Takahashi and Goichi Suda and stuff like that. But there's also stuff in this game that is just... unnecessarily frustrating. Like, the save system is atrocious. The difficulty is super spiky. Like, the pathfinding, like, and, you know, the primary mechanic is directing all your little citizens that have these different, like, classes or jobs, and their pathfinding is terrible. Like, the targeting controls in general are really not very good. And all the stuff that is just kind of like, would have, it feels like it would have been just sort of eliminated just through best practices in, like, a North American or European game. Just, it feels like very old school, but it's old school stuff that we got rid of because we realized it doesn't actually make the game any better.
Right.
And then the worst thing, Michael, did you actually finish the game?
No, I have to admit, I almost finished it, I think. But, I think I've seen all the bosses except the last one.
Yeah, so... The final sequence to the game is one of the most, like, it was the only time this year I almost, like, snapped that Wii remote in half just because it was so frustrating. Because there's this insanely long both series of cutscenes and gameplay sequence to get to the last boss. And once you get to the final fight, you're not able to go back at all. Like, once you engage in this very long process, you can't return from it. But you're supposed to select, like, which of your little citizens you bring with you and the kind of things they can do. There's, like, you know, soldiery ones and explorer ones and builder ones. And when you kind of engage in this last sequence, you have no idea that it's coming, right? Like, you get this brief warning that says, once you start, you won't be able to go back. But you have no idea what you're going to find. So you don't know if it's just going to be like more of an exploration thing, if it's just a fight or what. So the first time I went into this end sequence, I had like a pretty good mix of my little citizens. And then I could not, for the life of me, finish the boss at the end. Like, basically, you just need all soldier fighty types, right? So then I finally, and you can't go back to change the characters you have with you. So if you can't beat it with the guys you've got, you're just stuck. So I had to stop, leave, started from my last save point. And I had to go through this entire, like, it took me, I looked at my clock and it was 45 minutes later doing the exact same stuff, watching the cutscenes, going through this gameplay sequence over and over until I finally got back to that end thing. And it was, I really wanted to finish the game. I knew it was the end, but it was just so maddening. I was like, this doesn't improve your game at all.
Yeah.
Right. And maybe it was just like a thing where they ran out of time or something, but it was, I was very nonplussed about that. But then to bring it back around to the thing I love is that when you get to the end, it's sort of like the game completely unpacks itself in terms of kind of the metaphor it's been using. And this is the thing that you don't totally realize until you get to the end of the game, and I'm going to spoil it. So sorry. but basically, through the whole game, you've been playing almost like this young child who has been imagining this whole, like, crazy fantasy world where he's the king and all this stuff, right? And all the bosses and all the enemies are people actually from this young child's life. Like, one of the bosses is huge drunk. It's actually his drunken uncle.
Like, oh my God.
Big, fat, crazy boss is one of his teachers at school. And the last world you go to in the game itself before, like, the end sequence is unfinished. Like, it is literally unfinished. Like, there's still pencils there, and it's really rough. It's really low res. There's, like, compasses. And it's literally because he hasn't finished building this, like, area of his like, play imagination thing yet. And
that's adorable.
Yeah, it was just such a cool use of metaphor that I was like, this is brilliant. And you don't like you kind of suss that out as you're playing, but it's really like super laid bare at the end.
And I really wish you'd shared those two things in the other order, because you would have left me with the, oh, but there's no way in hell I'm going to play it. And instead, now you've got me going, oh, but maybe it would be worth all the frustration.
Well, as long as you go into the last sequence with a whole bunch of soldiery types, then you're fine. Just don't have any dead weight, because it is a lot of trouble. But
a wonderful game.
That use of metaphor was so awesome. And a very similar thing. I know a lot of people were kind of mixed about it, but I absolutely loved Brutal Legend. And it did a very, very similar thing in kind of a different way, right? It's like, So let's take, you know, those fights between the heavy metal kids and the goth kids that erupted in like high school hallways over whose music is better, and actually make them real battles in this crazy metal world, right? Hmm. And like that use of things in the real world that are kind of made metaphor in a game is just so, so cool. And it doesn't happen nearly enough, right? Like most games try to be
awkward adolescence laid bare. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, so many games try to be realistic where, you know, realistic exists in whatever world, but it doesn't consciously sort of grab onto and just go crazy with the sort of metaphor stuff that you can do. And that like is so, so rich, and we don't exploit like nearly enough.
You know, it's funny. The game, what really hooked me, you said it at the very beginning. It's so, so, so stylish, this game. It's got it. Yes, it's repetitive, and yeah, the pathfinding. I mean, you go up a hill and you lose three of your soldiers. You're like, where do they go? Oh, they're like all running in place on the side of the hill because they can't move. You know, they missed the ladder, they missed whatever. So you have to go back and get them. I mean, that just drives you crazy. But you know, it's a game that really is underneath it all, trying to explore something really, really interesting that games very rarely want to think about, you know? And it, part of it is that you're being led by this kind of deluded character who keeps telling you, hey, let's take this land. Hey, let's take this land. We really have got to do this. We really need this. And you're like, I'll do it. It's part of the game. But you slowly start to think, what are we doing here? Like, I'm just annihilating these people and taking their land. And you sort of need to make your kingdom grow. But the game leaves plenty of room for you to interpret that experience. And actually, other characters comment on it. And you sort of start to think, this charming little cartoony game is really at the center of it, exploring some really kind of ugly, self-indulgent fantasy kind of themes. Yeah. It's really got under my skin.
Oh, it's fantastic. And then, like, after you finish every world, you get another princess as a wife. And at one point, one of your advisors is like, hey, boss, maybe you should cut down on this polygamy. It's kind of, I mean, whatever you want, my liege. I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. I am a polygamist. This is really weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope people will give this game a try. I always want games that try to be different to sell. You know, I always want them to sort of, there to be some reward to the developer for them trying something different. But if you're willing to give it a shot, you know, and I would say with this game, this game's worth playing even if you don't intend to finish it. You know, just like, just see what it's all about. Just go take a look at this game and spend a few hours with it just to sort of see what a game that tries to do something different by cobbling together various gameplay styles, but also really putting its own, I would say completely, like utterly unique, stylish spin on it. It's a world and a set of characters and an art style I've never seen in any video game.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just kind of was, I'm trying to finish Mother 3 before the end of the year. Like, I started it much earlier in the year and haven't finished it yet. But as I was thinking about that and then thinking about, you know, kind of the game I wanted to talk about here, I realized that there is kind of a pretty big, like, thematic, you know, similarity between the Little King story and all the stuff by Shigatsu Itoi, who did, you know, all the Earthbound games, and that they just have this, you know, they're dark, but they're also really lighthearted at the same time. Mother 3 especially, right?
Oh.
Like, it's just, it's so bizarre, and it's really only a thing that the Japanese ever do, or at least do well. And it's very cool and interesting in that capacity. So for folks who kind of dig the Earthbound Mother type of things, it might also appeal in that regard.
Very cool. Well, this is Little King's Story. And it's Nell's favorite game of 2009. You know, fix your Wii, get your sensor bar going. No,
it's totally fixed now.
All right, good. I'll send you the game, Lee. I'll send it to you.
No, I have it.
Oh,
I've
you got it.
It.
Okay, you got it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. See, I just really want you to play this game.
I will. I'll play it like this weekend. Swear to God.
Awesome.
Well, you got things to do.
I've wanted to. It's just kind of, I was very busy this year because unlike the rest of you guys, I have to play games all the time.
See, and Nels, do you have this feeling, or Corvus, like the second I say that to her, the very next thought I have is, oh my God, she's going to hate it. Like, oh my God, she's going to hate it. And then I'm just like wasted her time. I always think that when I recommend it.
I think a lot of people do that with me.
No, I wanted it for sure. That's actually, it's definitely, I love everything of that is cut from that cloth. I'm a big, you know, sort of character management fan, and being able to get married to princesses pretty much guarantees that I'm going to play it. So I don't know why I like that. You know, I'm big on the Harvest Moon matchmaking and I even played Princess Debut. Like, I'll play it. Don't worry.
Yeah, actually, one of the key guys involved on Little King Story was the guy who produced and came up with Harvest Moon. So
yeah, no, I know. On the publisher side mostly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I met those guys and I spoke to them when they demoed it for me. And I was like, oh, yeah, you guys know me. I'll play it.
Awesome.
Well, Lee, let's toss the ball to you then. What's your favorite game of 2009?
Demon's Souls.
Yeah.
I knew it.
Yeah. Ta-da.
Totally called it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, honestly, Demon's Souls is really the only game this year that I kind of felt anything about on a set, like only commercial game this year that I kind of felt anything about on a sentimental level at all. And then there was like the late day Dark Horse after I had already made all my lists for people was, I also love Silent Hill Shattered Memories, but Demon's Souls was my favorite all year.
So a lot of us have written about this game. I know you've talked about it. Various people have had their say about this game. Did it grab you for any certain reason or a collection of reasons?
Well, it's so funny when Corvus was talking about his book that he wants to put in a cement brick and throw into the bottom of the ocean, and yet he loves it very much. That's probably how I feel about it. honestly, I've played it for 10 minutes, and I had to review it. So I was playing. I was like, are you serious? Like, how much more of this do I have to do before I can write the review? I played it for 10 minutes and I was like, I can't do this. I don't understand it. But for some reason, I kept trying. And that's pretty rare for me. I'm very easily frustrated. If I am too frustrated too quickly, that's it. Like, I'm not going to play it. Like, if I die 3 times on a level, the game is over. Like, that's sort of the kind of player that I am. I don't tolerate being frustrated. Like, you know, I like to be challenged. But usually if something is really opaque and I'm slamming my head against it, I lose patience very, very fast.
There's challenging and there's finicky.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I guess some of the games that I really have loved all my life, I guess you could say are hard and I've had to try a million times. So I guess it depends on the situation. But I wanted to keep playing, even though, you know, I had to play. I didn't really have a choice but to play a lot of it. But I was like, you know, maybe I'll just pick this up and go out, you know, and I can finish the review later. But I was like, why do I want to keep trying? And I was so curious to find out why I couldn't put it down that I kept playing. And the more I played, the more I discovered about how to kind of make my way in the game world. And I spent like 3 or 4 hours in the same 10 or 15 minute stretch of gameplay. And I really realized why it hooked me. You know, first of all, it feels really good to play. It feels really logical. I've really had a hard time verbalizing. I guess for one, the combat mechanics are very targeted. So you really feel a sense of control. Like, I'm a big fan of melee combat in general, like your Devil May Cry, Bayonetta, God of War, where you just sort of kind of line yourself up a little bit and then start executing a whole bunch of sweet combos and it doesn't really matter where you're aiming. You know, Demon's Souls is not really like that. You know, so I'm really using my head while I'm playing. It is engaging me intellectually constantly. And the key, I've said this a bunch of times, but the key, I think, to why it's so appealing is when you die, you only have yourself to blame. It doesn't feel like the game screwed you. It doesn't feel like the game surprised you. It doesn't feel like, you know, oh, wait, oh, shoot, on a reflex level, I wasn't ready. It was like, no, I didn't strategize correctly. You know, it is appealing for the reason that strategy is appealing, only it's in real time. Yeah. So it's constantly requires that your face be pressed to it, which, you know, for me was really interesting. I've been kind of bored with games for a while. I mean, to put it quite bluntly, but when I played something like this, that reminds me why challenge can be meaningful, and why accessibility is not, you know, why it's a good thing that it's not so accessible or game for everyone. You know, I really, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
The game teaches you how to play it.
Exactly. Yep. That's another really strong thing about it.
It's amazing how well it does that. And partly by for punishing you and partly for just being really smart about you quickly understand that if I do this, this is good. If I do this, this is bad. And yep. That just sticks with you. The funniest thing with this game, if you don't mind me, I just want to.
Please.
Tom Bissell, you know Tom. He writes
he's
for Chris
Mine.
Yeah, you know Tom. So he's going to be a guest. He's going to be a first-time Gamers Confabber here in a couple of days.
Oh, cool.
So I'm very excited to have him on.
And man, I wish I could have been on that one so I could use him.
Sorry.
Thanks.
Jeez. Well, he really struggled. I mean, like, I would say the most memorable gaming experience I've had this year, I wasn't actually me playing a game. To be frank, I love Demon's Souls. It was about nursing Tom Bissell through Demon's Souls with Chris Dallin.
Yeah.
Chris and I both have this.
No, you guys told me.
Oh my God, this
unnatural. You should publish that.
We
should publish the email chain. I am going to call for you to publish it. Because I always give Tom shit like for being mainstream. I'm like, yeah, whatever. You're not going to figure this one out. I'm like, you know, it's like you should like go play Wii Fit. You know?
Well, I have a message from Matt. He kept saying he's quitting. I'm quitting. He kept saying he was quitting. And then I'd go on the PS3 and there he'd be, you know?
Yeah.
Tom Bissell, Demon's Souls. And so I'm like, oh, he's still playing. And so I'd get these little messages, you know, and I'd be like, I'll try to encourage him. So I'd be like, hey, great. Look what you've done. And he sent me back like, go to hell. So he's just angrily, you know, making his way through the game.
That was the experience that I had with it, too. Yeah. You know, I was angry at it and I couldn't put it down.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think there's something about because the game teaches you, then you sort of feel, and I don't care about game facts. I don't go to those places if I can avoid them. I
needed game facts to get me through the first world, and I haven't needed game facts since I was like, or the equivalent. I've never needed game facts. I've needed like strategy guides. But
Yeah. Well, this one, I have to confess, I really stuck to my plan. I honestly finished this game without doing game facts. And I will admit that Chris mentioned.
How long did it take you to finish it without help?
It took me 103 hours.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I never do that ever. I mean, that was me like 15 years ago doing that.
There are three games that I've put that number of hours into, actually. Only three, though.
Yeah. 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 I mean, what are the three, just out of curiosity?
Final Fantasy 12, because I'm a side quest junkie. Harvest Moon, the GBA one, and Pokemon Pearl.
Oh, well, okay.
Yeah.
Since I stopped playing WoW, I think the only game I put that much time into was Fallout 3.
Oh, yeah. I'd probably get up there with Fallout eventually, too.
Because I played it once at about like 40-something hours. And then as soon as I was done, I just started again, did it again. And that plus the DLC is probably somewhere around 100.
Mm.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, it is this. I've mentioned this in the previous segment that I did yesterday, but you know, it is a tremendously satisfying victory.
I'm impressed. What class did you play as? Like, what was your?
I was a magi character. Yeah.
Oh, see, I couldn't do that.
I put everything into my magic and into intelligence so that I could carry more. You know, my blue bar would be.
But didn't it bother you? You don't get to do the up. You know, I like to hit things, man.
Yeah, you know, if you upgrade your weapons, I had this sword that I kept upgrading with all the shard stones and stuff, and it was pretty good. I mean, I could beat. There's one boss that you can't use magic on. You have to go, you know, melee.
Yeah.
And I was able to handle her. I think it's a she. I can't. The gender's hard to tell on this one, but I hung in there and lost a couple times, but then on the third time I was able to get her, and it that's another great thing about the game is you don't have to totally specialize or you're screwed. You know, you can be mostly one thing, but you can also dabble in in Melee, if you sort of enjoy that and get away with it enough of the time that it doesn't hurt you.
I liked that too. Another thing that brings up something else I really think is admirable about Demon's Souls. You know, class system is part of so many games that we're playing now. You know, your character class, you love, even like now that Western RPGs are such a, you know, much bigger thing, you know, we're always picking our class. Like, what are we going to play as? Who are we going to play as? And what are our attributes going to be? And a lot of, especially even in Japanese RPGs, it always has felt really arbitrary in a lot of ways. It's either very controlled, so it's like, doesn't quite matter what you pick, or it's so arbitrary that, again, it doesn't matter what you pick. Do you guys know what I mean?
Oh, like, yeah.
You cease to feel that the allocation of your points or the equipment that you've chosen, you cease to feel that A, you have much control over it, and B, that it makes much of a difference anyway. So it's right. Like, why make me bother with all of these different things and numbers and points and equipment when it doesn't even matter in the end? But with Demon's Souls, it really does. Like, it's very subtly reflects what you put into your character.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of
Does it dramatically change the game play itself? Do you almost feel like you're playing a different game if you select different classes?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I think what it allows you to do is to really fine-tune it for your personal, specific, individual, preferred method of playing. You know, everyone's going to handle it in a slightly different way. You ever know, like, even games that there's only one way to play, everyone's going to have a little bit of a different tactic, or, you know, some people are double tappers and some people are runners. You know what I mean? So it's like, no matter what you're playing, everyone has a slightly different style, and Demon's Souls really, really accommodates that. Like, I don't think that any two players are going to have an alike character and an alike gameplay style. Yeah. And it allows that, which I think is brilliant.
That's cool. I wonder if part of that falls out of, like, kind of a pseudo lineage with tactical RPG games, like, you know, Final Fantasy Tactics or whatever, right? Where that's one of those games where the class selection really, really, really does matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, how you build your party, that really determines how you play, and that they were able to kind of do that, but compress it into just a single character. That's very cool.
Yeah, and you've got to pay attention to the world you're in, because it puts you from one world to the next, and your strategy and your approach to getting things done in that world will change.
Yeah.
You really have to pay attention to what the game is asking you to do in different locations, because your strategy in one place doesn't work in another. And it's not always really just enemies. It's not just, this enemy requires this. And it's the environment itself.
World tendency, which I constantly was blowing the world tendency because it died constantly. And everything I went to eventually turned black. I left a ruined land in my wake because I was just such a liar.
One thing it does sort of point out to you what an ugly person you are inside when you, like, you get beat up so badly in the early stages of that game. You die. Then when you get powerful, man, you go back to that first area in Boletaria and you just wipe those skeletons out. You know, just like, I just use magic on them. They were done in one sharp hit, and I would just mow my way through them. I did that several times just because it felt good.
It does. That's what it's like. You know what? I remember what it felt like to be scraping my way through here, and now I'm awesome. Like, you know, and now I know where I'm going. I was lost, and now I know this place like the back of my hand. It's so satisfying. I have not been satisfied by a video game in like a year and a half now. So it was fun.
Awesome. Do you guys know how long it took to develop Demon's Souls?
No idea. Do you?
No.
Because as someone who makes games, it's just very interesting to think about what their process was like to get that sort of level of difficulty right. Because I don't know if you just play test it like to the nth degree, because it seems like there'd be a bit of a danger of the people making it who are super used to the tactics and all that stuff, not seeing how hard it is. And just, I mean, this happens constantly with lots of games, right? Like the team building it, you get all these structures and stuff into your head and you can't take it back out. You know, you can never come at your own game tabula rasa. Right. And obviously, that Demon's Souls did that, you always feel like you're in control, that you're responsible for your own failure. The fact that they were able to execute on that so well just makes me tremendously curious about how they actually did that.
Yeah. No, I interviewed the producer for my Kotaku piece on the game, and was told by them that they were very, very conscious of what the difficulty level was, and that to make it hard was a very targeted choice and not an arbitrary one, that they weren't like, let's just amp up the difficulty for old school's sake. In part, it was to encourage people to use the multiplayer system. And then also for the specificity of the experience. But because they wanted to encourage people to be aware of and assist each other, the difficulty is so hard that you would eventually have to rely on people was the result. And actually, what I think is really, it's interesting because they had the goal of implementing this multiplayer system where you're going to have other people's phantoms help you out, or you're going to be able to earn this or that by helping others. And they said it was, he said it was inspired by the anonymous Samaritan kind of concept. But then when you look at what Michael and Chris did for Tom, that's even taking place outside of the game that, people are writing facts for each other and helping each other. Like, you cannot play Demon's Souls alone, whether within the game world or outside of it. Like, you need to be able to share and discuss with people. So I think it's kind of funny that that Michael and Chris had a out of game Samaritan result with their friend.
Right.
So.
Yeah, it was fun, and I shouldn't suggest that in the end, I think Tom had to, sort of muscle himself up with upgrades and things, and he, handled business on his own. You can only help somebody so much in that game.
Yeah, but, I imagine he probably needed a lot of help until eventually you had to give up. I hope he's listening to this.
Yeah, and not even Chris has finished it, so. Corvus, have you seen this game or played it?
I've not played it. No, I don't have don't have the platform. So,
okay.
I watched all of the Twitter conversation happen about it while everybody was playing it, and I couldn't decide if I was really intrigued or took it as fair warning.
Yeah,
it's not fun. I mean, it's not fun. It just feels good.
I'm still
good.
Not sure. Yeah, I'm still not sure where I'd land on it, but it's certainly something I'm going to have to check out once I finally get my PS3.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that's certainly emerging, and last year when we did this, I don't know if you recall, but we had about 18, 19 of these guests, and everyone chose a different game. And that was partly by, we shuffled things around a little bit, and I put people in groups to make sure that they were all different. But this time I didn't really worry about that so much, and Demon's Souls is clearly being chosen by several people. It seems that there's more of a consensus than there was before. And I don't know what that means, but it seems to be the case. Well, we are going to wrap it up here, but I asked each of my three guests to think about a game that they might be looking forward to in 2010, for whatever reason, a game that's sort of on the horizon. So we'll go around the horn one more time and see if you guys have one game that you'd like to sort of point at for our benefit. Corvus?
Wow, that's just a tricky one for me. I haven't really looked much into the upcoming year. I do know a couple of people that I admire very much who are working on a game called Deathspank that's coming out next year.
No, seriously.
It's on the must-buy list, and it looks like it's a lot of fun, and I really, speaking of, talking about great art styles, it's got a really compelling art style.
We should say, in case you don't happen to know this, that Nels is working on that game.
Disclaimer.
There's an indie game coming out next year by the only game designer right now who uses text-heavy game mechanics that I actually find compelling enough to sit down and play, because that's certainly not any of your big RPG houses for me. I hate the stapling of text into my games. But Deirdre Kiai is funded a game that she's going to be working on called Life Flashes By, for the way she treats text in games is the text is the point, it is the game mechanic, and it's so raw and honest that I'm really looking forward to a larger project from her. She has a lot of small projects on her website, but this one's going to be bigger in scope, and I'm excited about that.
Absolutely. This is a story that you should write, Lee, although maybe somebody else has already written. I just don't know about it. But the rise in games that have been funded by the community.
Yeah.
Hers was, and she announced it, and I think various of us got excited about it based on her description. But it seems like with Killscreen and various other kind of online projects, going to the community and getting people excited.
Kickstarter stuff.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Some people have been blogging a lot in Gamasutra's expert section. I think expert, not members. Yeah. But if you check Gamasutra blogs, or if you search our site, people have been really taking interesting looks at that. Like, they got to it before I did. So.
Gotcha.
Yeah, Barut Pfeiffer, he wrote a piece about that.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah,
Deirdre, a few other people.
Yep, I will check that out. I obviously missed that. And Barut himself, had a project out there sort of looking for funding to it, which is much more ambitious in that case. But
yeah.
Cool. All right. So yes, Deirdre Kiai, and I'll she's been a guest on the show, and we'll make sure we link to that project when we put the podcast out.
Excellent.
So what about you, Nels?
So just personally, I'm very excited to get Deathbank wrapped. That's so y'all can play it.
Yay.
But I don't know if I could pick just one. I'm definitely excited about BioShock 2. You know, the Jordan Thomas's cradle level from the third Thief game is still one of my favorite moments in a game ever. And of course, Steve's working on all that, so that's pretty exciting. Obsidian's going to release Alpha Protocol, and since Chris Avalon wrote Planescape Torment, which is still one of my favorite games of all time, seeing something from them, because they haven't released anything in quite a while, anything totally original in quite a while is pretty exciting. I'll stick my flag on that one.
Cool. How about you, Lee?
Well, for me, definitely BioShock 2. I mean, I'm such a fan of the original BioShock, but my little like super excited thing is I can't wait for No More Heroes 2. I'm so excited for that.
Yes.
I love No More Heroes. Love. So that one. God, I can't wait to see if Heavy Rain can put its money with it where its mouth is. I cannot wait for that. I mean that makes it sound like
Omicron.
Yeah, it makes it sound like I'm a cynical bully, but no, I'm really looking forward to seeing. I mean, they've been speaking so highly of what they've been working on that I can't wait to see it. You know? I mean, wait, no, I know that's... Okay, well, fine.
If I weren't so much willing just to step up and start throwing punches on this, I wouldn't be laughing so hard.
No, I mean, like, okay. And, you know, there are a lot of designers that I respect quite a lot that have talked a good game that they couldn't quite deliver on this year and even last year. And they still talk, you know, so, you know, I would love to see if it achieves what it has said it aims to. And regardless,
awesome.
Regardless, I'm looking forward to seeing what the effort looks like in practice. But I'm just like that, like No More Heroes 2. Can we have a launch party for that? I'm so excited. Oh, yeah.
Well, and the 360 and PS3 version of the first one, right?
Oh yeah, but I honestly I think that like defeats the point. Like there are very few games that I think are like No More Heroes like orgiastically fun to play on Wii, and it works so well. And there are very few games that do for me. So
yeah, I'm just curious. You mentioned it. We won't pursue this, Lee, but I just real quick. Does Silent Hill Shattered Memories belong on the Wii? Is that one of those games that
Yes.
So we'll talk about that later. I just started playing it last night. We were actually chatting about it before you joined us in the recording here. And
yes, buy it.
Cool. All right.
Buy it.
Very good. Well, I want to thank all three of you very much for joining me. It's been a terrific conversation, and these are games that we hope others will take a look at if they haven't already. We'll make links on the site, as I said before. But I want to wish you all a happy new year, and thanks for being gamers confabbers, the veterans that you are. I really, really appreciate it.
You're a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's always fantastic. Thanks, Michael.
Very cool. All right. Take care. Happy new year.
Happy New Year, guys.
It was wonderful speaking to you.
Take care.
Always.
Bye.